Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this segment we're going to begin an examination of a number of recent incidents of apparent right-wing slash Nazi terror. I use the word apparent because there is still a great deal more to be discovered about these particular incidents. The political rhetoric surrounding these incidents, as with the Oklahoma City bombing, I think is completely inadequate. The American progressive forces and the government have been attributing this to paramilitary right-wingers and the, quote, militias, unquote. And in turn, the militias and the Patriots networks, as they're known, have been attributing this to the government. In part two of this discussion, we're going to be examining my working hypothesis, which is that some elements of the militias and some elements of the government are in all probability involved, however, not all of either the government or the militias and patriot networks. I think the political debate so far has been oversimplified. However, we're going to get into that discussion in part two. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article from the San Francisco Examiner of Tuesday, October 10th of 1995. In that paper, there's a Hugh Delios article. That's D-E-L-L-I-O-S. He is a Chicago Tribune writer. It's datelined Hyder, Arizona, spelled H-Y-D-E-R, and headlined, Saboteurs Sought in Amtrak Tragedy, subheaded, Prober Seeking, quote, Sons of Gestapo. The article reads in part as follows. Federal agents sought to identify the, quote, sons of Gestapo, unquote, after a sabotage attack Monday derailed Amtrak's Sunset Limited, killing a trainman and injuring scores of passengers. No one seems to have heard of Sons of Gestapo, the group whose name was on anti-government tracts found at the scene of the derailment in the Arizona desert. By the way, in just a minute, we're going to take a look at an article from the Christian Science Monitor indicating that people have, in fact, heard of a white supremacist group called the Sons of the Gestapo. More about that in a minute. Skipping down in the article, we read, Railroad and government officials said the sabotage required only 10 minutes of privacy and a rudimentary knowledge of railroading. Quote, this type of derailing goes back to the Spanish Civil War and beyond, unquote, said Brian Jenkins, a counterterrorism expert with Kroll Associates, a New York-based firm that specializes in corporate security. Quote, trains are terribly vulnerable, and there are any number of guerrilla manuals describing how to derail them, unquote. Two notes were found near the crash site. They refer to the federal sieges at Waco, Texas, and Ruby Ridge, Idaho, both rallying points for anti-government extremists on the far right. The note was signed Sons of Gestapo, according to local police. Authorities said they had no record of such a group, and Klan Watch, an organization that tracks hate groups as part of the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery, Alabama, also had never heard of Sons of Gestapo, said Joe Roy, Klan Watch director. He said it could be some kind of local group or, quote, this could be Fred the Farmer who's mad at Amtrak for cutting across his land, unquote. Skipping down again, an electronic database search of U.S. newspapers, internet discussion groups, and worldwide web pages also turned up no mention of a Sons of Gestapo. Oliver Buck Revell, a former associate deputy director of the FBI, said he was dubious of the name Sons of Gestapo. Revell said, it doesn't appear anybody in the FBI is familiar with this being a real group. The only time I have seen similar names was with skinheads who use names like Sons of Hitler and other Nazi things. I would note in passing that Oliver Buck Revell is an individual who was part of the interagency government networks that were set up pursuant to the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism. That Vice President at the time was former CIA Director George Bush. Those networks, in turn, were used to basically set up sort of a government within a government that was involved in a number of illicit activities, including the Iran-Contra scandal, both the Contra supply effort and the Iranian arms transfers, as well as the Iraqgate scandal, or the arms transfers involved in that. One of the components of these interagency government networks that was basically state-sponsored terrorism. And I find Oliver Revell's comments here interesting, though certainly one cannot draw a conclusion from that. Please note, however, that whatever the reality concerning the authorship of this particular act of sabotage, there is, in fact, evidence that there is a group called the Sons of the Gestapo. Whether or not that group was, in fact, involved in this particular terrorist act. We will discuss some of the possibilities in this regard in the second part of this particular series. Research credit on the following article goes to a listener who was reading the Christian Science Monitor of October 13th of 1995. In that edition of the Christian Science Monitor, there's an article by an enterprising journalist named Daniel B. Wood, W-O-O-D, a staff writer of the Christian Science Monitor. This article is datelined Gila Bend, Arizona, and it's headlined On the Dusty Trail of the Amtrak Terrorists. Subheaded, Combing Through Rural Arizona Draws Some Clues and Scowls. Skipping down in this particular article, we read about some of the people that Daniel B. Wood interviewed. And although Daniel B. Wood was not able to come across the sons of the Gestapo himself, he was able to come across people who were familiar with a white supremacist group, apparently composed largely of young people, perhaps so-called skinheads. So there does appear to be some information that, in fact, a Sons of the Gestapo group does exist, whether or not they were involved in this particular terrorist act. Skipping down in this particular story from the Christian Science Monitor of October 13th of 1995, we read, I never found the elusive fraternity, although I did talk to several people who said they knew members. Instead, with cellular phone in hand, I crisscrossed a Saguaro-studded corner of America that experts say is a haven for extremist groups. There were plenty of friendly people, and plenty who prefer to be left alone. Quote, Arizona is a remote, rural state that is very tolerant to strangers and accepting of those carrying guns, unquote, says Margaret Singer, a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and cult expert. The state is a haven for the disenfranchised because they can be accepted while at the same time not be noticed, unquote. I met Larry Dean, D-E-A-N, on my way back from the derailment site. He said he has known about the Sons of Gestapo since he was a kid growing up in this rural desert. This paragraph again. I met Larry Dean on my way back from the derailment site. He said he has known about the Sons of Gestapo since he was a kid growing up in the rural desert. Quote, There's white supremacists all over these parts. It's their territory, unquote, says the beak-capped flagger who directs crop-dusting plains southwest of Phoenix. Holding that many urban-based supremacist groups are troublemakers who give Sieg Heil salutes and act, quote, obnoxious and tough, unquote, in groups, Mr. Dean says the more rural, quote, Gestapo, unquote, members are low-key and keep to themselves. He and friend Dustin Brooks have run into them often at heavy metal rock concerts. Quote, I've been laid out by him a couple of times, unquote, says Mr. Brooks, standing outside the Desert Rose Cafe near where the Amtrak passenger train was derailed Monday. And skipping down, for all he knows about skinheads and supremacists, flagger Larry Dean thinks that the Sons of Gestapo members he knows would not have left a note at the scene of a crime. Quote, That's not their style, unquote, says Dean. They're not that smooth, and they wouldn't want to attract attention to themselves. I think it's someone who just wanted to start some race stuff going here and wanted to smear the Sons, unquote. That is a possibility I hold open. There are other possibilities as well. One of them concerns the possibility of leaderless resistance, as formulated by Louis Beam, a white supremacist leader, whom I have discussed in the past. A leaderless resistance involves the breaking up, or the organization, I should say, of white supremacist groups into small cells, which would then be much more difficult to penetrate by government infiltrators or infiltrators of any kind. In turn, these small cells could be used to perpetrate various terrorist acts and would basically represent subgroups of these larger organizations. One of the possibilities that I think should be considered is that if, in fact, this Sons of Gestapo group actually does exist, as some of the people contacted by Mr. Wood of the Christian Science Monitor indicate, that perhaps a subgroup, a cell of the Sons of Gestapo is involved. We're going to discuss the possibilities concerning authorship and motive of this and other terrorist acts later on in this particular series. Simply note, however, for the record, that the Christian Science Monitor of October 13, 1995, does carry an interview with people who have heard of a Sons of Gestapo group. So whether or not that group or elements thereof was involved, there does appear to be such a group. I would also note that at right about this time, shortly thereafter, there was another terrorist incident also involving mass transit. This, however, was in the eastern United States at LaGuardia Airport in New York. Reading now from the Los Angeles Times of Sunday, October 15th of 1995, we find a Washington Post story by Pierre Thomas and Don Phillips. It's headlined, Bomb Damage at New York Airport Seen as Possible Terrorist Act. a bomb damaged a transmitter and wind shear detection system serving New York's LaGuardia Airport, and authorities have launched a full-scale investigation into possible domestic terrorism after discovering a note containing intense anti-government rhetoric. While federal authorities could not immediately determine whether Friday's assault on an unmanned site at the old Flushing Airport about 2 miles from LaGuardia was a terrorist act, the tone of a handwritten note discovered at the scene left them no choice but to look into that possibility, officials said Saturday. The note, which displayed a swastika, mentioned the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and the FBI, and suggests that the bombing was in retaliation for federal law enforcement's role in the 1993 standoff with Branch Davidians near Waco, Texas. It did not identify its author or assign responsibility to any group, sources said. Initial indications suggest that some type of crude explosive device was used, one law enforcement source said. Damage to the wind shear detection system was immediately recognized by airport officials, and there was no safety threat to LaGuardia. The bombing, which occurred about 4 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time Friday, came on the heels of the sabotage early last week of an Amtrak train outside Phoenix. Typewritten notes found after the Arizona attack attributed it to a group called Sons of Gestapo, made references to the ATF and the FBI, and alluded to the violent conflicts near Waco and Ruby Ridge, Idaho. Sources said the styles of the notes were different, but they were pondering whether the New York incident was a copycat action. Well, I would note in that particular regard that there was an arrest made in connection with this particular incident, with the individual, as far as I know, has not come to trial. Reading now from the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, November 24th of 1995, we find a Reuters story, Dateline New York, and headlined, Teen Accused of Conspiracy in LaGuardia Airport Bombing. It reads, a teenager has been charged with conspiracy and possession of an explosive device in connection with a blast that damaged the wind shear detection system at LaGuardia Airport, police said yesterday. A note left at the site of the October 13th explosion said it was in retaliation for the 1993 attack by federal agents on the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas. A swastika was drawn on the note. But police say they did not believe that the 15-year-old had any connection to radical or terrorist groups. His name was not released because of his age. This article is interesting, though certainly by no means conclusive. First of all, it has yet to be proved that this individual was in fact involved with this particular terrorist act. I would also note that white supremacist groups, just like the Nazi Party of Hitler's Germany and Mussolini's Fascisti, had youth wings, or have youth wings. So the fact that someone is a teenager does not necessarily mean they're not involved with some sort of radical group. I would also note that there has been a fair amount of information disseminated through various sources, such as the Internet, concerning white supremacist groups and also how to make bombs. So it's possible that an individual, teenage or otherwise, with inclinations like this could gain that kind of information from other sources. I would also note that in this article, it says that the teenager has been charged with conspiracy. I wonder who he was conspiring with. One does not conspire by oneself. And although police said they did not believe that the individual had any connections with any radical or terrorist groups, I personally would not be so quick to jump to that particular conclusion. I would note that, as I said earlier, in the first go-round of fascism, that is the pre-World War II and World War II periods, the fascists of Italy and Hitler's German Nazi Party had youth wings, and in the latter case, during the closing stages of the war, many of those youth were committed to combat, and some of them gave good accounts of themselves. They were pressed into duty during the closing stages of the war when the Third Reich's manpower losses necessitated the drafting, the pressing into military service of people much older or much younger than would normally be called upon to serve. Some of those people, particularly some of the older and more physically mature members of the Hitler Youth, gave pretty good accounts of themselves in combat. So the fact that someone is a teenager does not necessarily mean they cannot pull off a terrorist act or be extremely dangerous. I would note in that particular regard that there was a recent mass shooting by a 16-year-old in Toulon, France. This article had quite a bit of publicity at the time. One aspect of this particular shooting, widely reported, at least in all of the newspapers that I read daily, this particular incident appears to have been perpetrated by a young Nazi or white supremacist affiliate. I would also note that apparently Toulon, a city in southern France, is a stronghold of Jean-Marie Le Pen's fascist Front National. We're going to take a brief look at some information concerning this particular shooting. And again, this particular incident took place earlier in 1995, specifically in October of 1995, I believe. And the incident was widely reported in many of the newspapers, but none of the papers that I saw mentioned that the individual who went on this shooting spree was apparently a young Nazi convert. We're going to turn for our information concerning this particular shooting to an excellent anti-fascist publication called The Searchlight. The Searchlight magazine comes out of Britain and can be contacted / subscribed to as follows.
To subscribe to The Searchlight, a British anti-fascist publication, write to Searchlight Magazine Limited, 37B New Cavendish Street, London, W1M8JR, or phone 011-4471-284-4040, or fax 011-4471-284-4410. That's the Searchlight Magazine Limited, 37B New Cavendish Street, London, W1M8JR, phone 011-4471-284-4040, or fax at 011-4471-284-4410.
That again for subscription information for Searchlight Magazine. In Searchlight Magazine's issue of November of 1995, there is a section called Reflex Reports France. Reflex is a French anti-fascist publication. By the way, they have an internet address that I will give you briefly. All small letters. http://www.anet.fr/. And then a small signal, I believe this is called a tilde. In fact, it is a sign called a tilde, T-I-L-D-E-A-R-I-S. Once again, http://www.anet.fr/tilde-A-R-I-S. That reflects a French anti-fascist publication with a similar focus to that of Searchlight. In the Reflex Reports France section of the Searchlight magazine for November of 1995, we read this item about the particular shooting, this shooting incident in Toulon. There's a picture of police covering up the victims of this individual. Police cover the body of one of the 13 victims of a 16-year-old Nazi who ran amok with a .22-caliber hunting rifle in Cures, C-U-E-R-S, a small town near Toulon in southern France. Excuse me, this incident was near Toulon, not in it. Continuing. The teenager kept pictures of Hitler and neo-Nazi books in his bedroom. Toulon is a stronghold of the Front National. Again, that's the French fascist organization of Jean-Marie Le Pen. Again, this particular incident was widely reported. I would note that none of the papers I read mentioned that this individual had Nazi / fascist and white supremacist connections. Again, the fact that someone might be young and relatively immature does not mean they cannot be a Nazi convert, or that they cannot do a great deal of physical harm. One of the things that I hold open in connection with not only the incident in Toulon, France, but also with regard to the Amtrak derailment, allegedly by the Sons of Gestapo, or elements thereof, as well as the incident in New York City, directed at LaGuardia Airport, or that wind shear detection device, that note blasting the ATF and the FBI for Waco, Texas, and Ruby Ridge had a swastika near it. A teenager has been arrested in connection with that. One of the possibilities I hold open is that, in fact, these incidents may actually have been performed by either adult or teenaged members of various white supremacist and / Nazi groups, perhaps cells thereof along the lines of Louis Beam's Leaderless Resistance. Another of the possibilities I hold open is that some of these groups, or all of them, may actually be directly descended, and I mean that quite literally, from elements of the Third Reich. We have not got time in this particular segment or in this series to go into the complex but very important fact that the Third Reich actually went underground, and many elements of the Third Reich were quite successful in surviving military defeat in World War II and have continued to function underground up to the present. Many of the individuals obviously involved in those groups are either old or deceased. However, there is evidence that in fact the Third Reich was quite successful in going underground, and that it has been able to wield a tremendous influence in the post-World War II world, albeit underground. I refer interested listeners to the RFA program number 37, available from archives on audio, a tape duplication service about which I will have more to say in a couple of minutes. In particular, examine the RFA 37 segments of August 9th of 1992, and September 20th and September 27th of 1992, particularly the September 20th, 1992 installment. Also, the second part of a miscellaneous archive show called Why Johnny Can't Identify Il Duce. That will contain more information about the Third Reich's elements that went underground. We're going to read a short segment now from a remarkable book called Quest, subtitled Searching for the Truth of Germany's Nazi Past. This book was co-authored by Ib Melchior, M-E-L-C-H-I-O-R, and Frank Brandenburg, B-R-A-N-D-E-N-B-U-R-G. It was published in softcover by the Presidio Press and copyrighted 1990. Ib Melchior is the author of a number of different books, as described on the back of this particular book. And Frank Brandenburg is a young German who, as a youth, became interested in the Third Reich and began doing research on it, and was actually able to become the friend of a number of key leaders of the Third Reich, or former leaders of the Third Reich. One of the most important of these was SS General Karl Wolff, last name W-O-L-F-F. Wolff was Himmler's personal adjutant. He was among the individuals who Frank Brandenburg contacted and with whom Frank Brandenburg eventually became a good friend. As a token of this friendship, Karl Wolff gave Frank Brandenburg his SS Death's Head ring, and this basically served to open the doors for Frank Brandenburg into the corridors of the Underground Reich, as I have termed it in numerous programs, namely those elements of the Third Reich that have survived into the post-World War II period and wielded a profound, although little recognized, influence. Turning now to Quest by Frank Brandenburg, we're going to examine some of the statements by SS General Karl Wolff concerning not only the Third Reich going underground, but concerning the raising up of a second generation. From this, I infer that not only have people been converted, young people been converted to the Nazi philosophy, but that in fact as the SS, the key element involved in going underground, perpetuated itself in the post-World War II period, that in fact they raised up a second generation. As we read in Quest, the discussion is of a key code word that the Third Reich Underground used to communicate with each other, and that was the name of Hitler's third dog. Joining this discussion, we read, quoting Frank Brandenburg, I still do not understand, Herr General, Frank said. How can knowing the name of Hitler's third dog be so important? Quote, when the war began to go badly for us, unquote, Wolff explained, again quoting, some of the highest-ranking men of the Reich realized that the day would come when, if they wanted to escape the vengeance of the victors and avoid giving up their pound of flesh to the international Jews, they would have to scatter throughout the world and go underground, as they say. The problem, then, became how to keep in touch without risking discovery. And keeping in touch was important, unquote. Why? The ideals of the Führer and the Reich could not be allowed to die, my boy. This was their primary pledge. Those ideals, those beliefs must be kept alive and nourished so that someday they may burn brightly in the world once again. And the keepers of the flame that would set them ablaze would have to be those of us who were still abroad in both senses of the world. But again, how to communicate in safety? And again, it was deemed that couriers knowledgeable about the name of Hitler's third dog would be the way to do that. Skipping down again. But that was a long time ago, he protested. There must be a lot of people who know that code name by now, unquote. That was Frank Brandenburg speaking. There are many more than the original few, Wolff agreed. Of necessity, so. Yes, we are growing old. But there is a new generation, Frank. A new generation taking our place, unquote. The old man gave his young friend a meaningful look. A new generation, and they are fully as ruthless, fully as dedicated to keeping alive and to protecting what was and is the Führer's. His eyes bored into Frank. Make no mistake about it, my boy, he said solemnly. The knowledge you now possess can be dangerous. Do not reveal what you have learned, but use it wisely and with care, unquote. And I've no doubt this conversation, by the way, took place shortly before Kohlberg's death in July of 1984. I've no doubt that his admonition to Frank Brandenburg was quite correct. The Underground Reich, as I have termed it, is very much a reality and can be exceedingly dangerous to those who tempt its wrath. One of the possibilities I hold open in connection with these terrorist incidents, some of them allegedly perpetrated by young people with white supremacist beliefs, is that some of them might actually be that second generation, perhaps even direct blood descendants of the SS underground that Wolf refers to in his statement. We're going to further examine the Amtrak derailment and some of these incidents in the second half of this particular discussion. Those of you who would like to pursue this research further can contact a tape duplication service called Archives on Audio. That's Archives on Audio. They are located at P.O. Box 170023, Box 17-0023. That is in San Francisco, zip code 94117-0023. The phone number is area code 415-346-1840. That's 415-346-1840. Write or phone to the attention of Paul. The archives have the archive documentaries are described in a catalog. That is a 20-page catalog that lists all of the archive shows, gives a synoptic description of each archive show, and cross-references the programs with other broadcasts containing similar or related material. Those of you who have access to the World Wide Web can dial up the web page for KFJC-FM. That is the home base station in the San Francisco Bay Area at which I record these programs, and access the KFJC webpage, which contains all of the archive show descriptions, plus a suggested reading list, and a list of other sources that one can access in order to pursue this line of research. The KFJC webpage can be contacted at the following address, all small letters, http://www.cygnus.com/kfjc.html. And again, neither myself nor KFJC-FM gets money from this particular arrangement. That concludes this particular segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.